Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 31st, 2003. Today's session is entitled Religion and Politics, Politics and Public Policy, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
Anyhow, glad to be here at my last talk relief today. I'm John Marty, a state senator from Minnesota, and have enjoyed a chance to talk about a number of different public policy or politically related topics. And today I'm going to talk about the mixing of how we connect faith and politics. And first of all, why talk about the connection between faith and politics? I'd argue two points. One is because we don't think about it, it's too important to do it wrong. And some politicians and activists will use religion and the religious text to prove the merit of their political agenda. They are not doing it to serve the religious beliefs, they're using it to serve their political agenda. And also because connections are inevitable. If we think of our faith as something we practice one morning a week and the rest of the time you do whatever you feel like, that might be different, but I think we see our faith as something that we live out 7 days a week and it's part of who we are. And as such, we can't divorce it from the other things we do in life. And same thing with politics. We're citizens, it's a democracy. We're the ones who are supposed to be running things. And so if we take that involvement as citizens seriously, certainly at a minimum voting and then perhaps being more active than that, expressing opinions, writing people, whatever. If we take our citizenship seriously, we can't. That's part of who we are too. And if our faith is part of us, of everything we do, then the two are going to be mixed. So how do we connect them? And talking about this would be important to start out mentioning the concept, an important one that we recognize about the importance of separating church and state. I mean, it's not written per se, there's not once in our Constitution does it say there should be a wall, a separation between church and state. No. But freedom of speech, freedom of religion requires that. Because any time you have somebody who gets to, a government who gets to interfere in religion, you get to big troubles. Whether that government is anti-religion or promoting a religion, one way or another, it's a dangerous thing, and I think our founding forefathers or founding fathers or foreparents recognize that, and the tension between where you draw the line and how you draw the line and what's somebody's free exercise of religion, what's government trampling on it, is something the courts have been dealing with for 230 years, and 230 years from now, presumably we will still be wrestling with related questions and fine-tuning how we separate the two and how we keep them separate. But separation of church and state is to keep the church, the government, from interfering with either in favor of some or against all or in favor of all religions. It's supposed to treat them with a sense of neutrality where we, the people, choose what we believe and government's not going to tell us.
Can I ask a question, John?
Yes, go ahead.
Does that mean no religion or equal treatment of religion?
It's supposed to be equal treatment of religion, but you've got to be careful. I mean, the whole point is government shall be no establishment of religion. They are not to push a religion or a non-religion. In other words, belief in a supreme being or no belief in a supreme being or belief that there is no supreme being. It's fully appropriate for any government official, for any citizen, anybody to have their religious beliefs. It begins to cross the line where government is beginning to promote a religion or whatever.
But the ACLU, right, really are pushing no religion. They want to wipe it all out.
I would argue that the ACLU wants government not to be promoting any religion. They should not be pushing anti-religion, and I know many people who are people of faith who are members of ACLU, but at times it times some people may, I mean, I know there's a group of Minnesota atheists who a number of years ago were having a big fight because some of us were trying to respect the religious beliefs of people who are faith healing type of thing, Christian Science people, because you get into real touchy issues with that when you have a parent who has a child who is sick and the child believes, the parent is Christian Science and therefore they believe it's against their religion for them to bring their child in for certain types of medical care. And we as a state have a very strong interest in saying that we won't allow you because you say it's your religious beliefs to deny medical care any more than we think it's okay for you to kill your child by beating them. We step in as a state in how you draw the line. I think we felt we had a good compromise in which if a parent had a child in Christian Science or other similar religion, had a child that was sick to a certain level, rather than make them criminally prosecuted, which is what's happened in a couple of places, for basically practicing the religion, we tried a thing in which they would have to report. They would have to report that their child was seriously ill, and they'd have to report it very promptly. And then, in effect, the state, through its authority, through child protection, whatever, could make its own determinations. And the parents may not be thrilled, but I think its most respectful way of bridging that difficult gap is for the state to say, we're going to provide this child this medical care because we think that's the appropriate thing to do. And it's the parents may say that intrudes on our religion some, but I think most of them recognize that it's a lot less intrusive than requiring them to provide a medical treatment that they think is immoral. And so there are going to be those tough lines to draw all the time. And it's something that, as I said, the courts will be wrestling with 100 years from now, as we are now. But again, religion separation is not to block people, and it couldn't block people from having faith and from being citizens, and therefore, if your faith influences all you do, it influences what you believe and how you vote and everything else. It's going to be a connection that government can't change. How do we connect the two of them? Well, first of all, I think that in recognizing our faith shapes us, I like the verse Micah chapter 6, verse 8, what does the Lord require of us but to seek justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with our God? And seeking justice, how do we seek justice? I think Holden Village people spend a lot of time trying to figure out how we are to bring a just world about. We talked about that at Jubilee last week. And each of us are called in our own way. Some are school teachers, some are computer programmers, some are housekeepers, some work as retail clerks, some as public officials. But all of us as citizens, we are to find ways to seek justice, and then what we mean by justice, our religious texts give us lots of clues of what is just and what is unjust in the world. And so we use our faith to shape what we're going to do politically and how we're going to work for a more just and fair and decent world. Instead of saying what we should do to connect, let me first start off by saying one of the things we shouldn't do. And that is we should not use our religion or our religious texts to prove or promote the merits of our political beliefs or our agenda. We say in one Lutheran liturgy, in many and various ways God has spoken to us of old by the prophets. Now in these last days he's spoken to us through his son. Not prophets, not politicians. When politicians say, I'm doing this because this is God's will, the gem of all, the best example of politicians using God that way was Pat Robertson in 1988. He was encouraged by Jesus Christ to run for president, and basically he said in so many words that he had been endorsed by God in his campaign, to which Doonesbury had a cartoon, and this is 15 years ago now, but it was a gem of a cartoon. You can see the lectern where Pat Robertson is speaking behind, and he's saying how his campaign's been endorsed by Jesus Christ. And one of the reporters, the next frame shows the reporters talking to each other, and one of them says, "Sure the heck beats an endorsement from the Teamsters." And that's part of the point. I mean, Jesus is a trump card in politics. Yeah, he's on my side. And that's not something new. Christian scripture has been used for both sides of the slavery issue. That was resolved 150 years ago, and I think we all agree it was resolved the right way. But until that time, there were people who very earnestly believed that Christianity argued in favor of slavery. And the Bible talks frequently about slavery. Those issues don't go away all at one time. It's not like, well, we learned 150 years ago. Jerry Falwell, 30 years ago, was arguing that scripture requires separation and segregation of the races. There's an individual in Minnesota who keeps writing sort of nasty letters to, anonymously for a long time, to mixed marriage couples or anything. Anybody read an article in the paper or see a picture of a black and white people together, and so on, he'd send them anonymously at the time hate mail. He was a, quote, good Christian. He was a big donor. Matter of fact, the chapel at Augsburg College, Lutheran College, was going to be named after him until it came out that he was the individual doing all this hate stuff. And he's very, we would argue, very warped perspective. But he argues separation of the races is biblically called for. Jerry Falwell called for that too. And Jerry Falwell knows what Jesus believes. And Jerry Falwell was president of Liberty University for many years, an equal opportunity employer, and they of course take students of every race. Jerry Falwell no longer believes in the mixing of races being anti-Christian. Jerry Falwell told us then what Jesus believed and what political agenda of Jesus would be, and he tells us now what it would be. Did Jesus change between 1965 and 2003? No, Jerry Falwell changed. The best one I've seen who explained the importance of not using our religion to using religion to prove the merit of our political case was Abe Lincoln's second inaugural address. He talks about with malice towards none, charity towards all, working together to bind up the nation's wounds. And it's a beautiful, the second inaugural address talks about how both sides prayed to the same God for victory and everything else. In the Civil War, and much more personal, where brother was fighting against brother, and father against son, depending on people in border states often had that happen. And I think Lincoln very much saw how God was called on by both sides as whatever. We still see that today in football games when both teams pray in a huddle before the game, pray for victory. As if God somehow is up there rolling the dice, and well, I think I want this team to win today. But that's something in human nature. We like to use our faith as a political trump card. And that's not the appropriate thing to do. That's not the way we should be doing it. Instead, we should use our faith and our scripture to inform our thinking and our understanding and shape our personal direction. So in other words, what I believe, what John Marty promotes in the Minnesota Senate, my agenda is my agenda. Am I a Christian? Yes. Do I take my faith seriously? Yes. I hope so. I hope it shows in how I live my life. But that's for me to get the direction on who I am, not for me to advertise, hey, I'm this good guy and vote for me because I'm such and such. Richard Neuhaus, the former Lutheran, now Catholic theologian, wrote this is 30 years ago, so very dated terms, so I'll sort of paraphrase it. And he says, the Bible doesn't tell us whether we're to take care of hungry children through a food stamp program or through soup kitchens or through higher wage laws for parents or how. The Bible does make it very clear to us that we are to do something about hungry children. And that is something, I mean, there are people who can read the Bible and come to a different conclusion. That would be a hard swallow for me. But the Bible talks repeatedly about our concern for the other person, the concern for the poor. concern for the oppressed. Where you have the political debate is how you deal with it. Okay, so we think we, and I just say we read our scripture and we find we're supposed to be concerned for the vulnerable. And so yes, we, in Newhouse's words, we're supposed to be concerned about hungry children that they don't go to bed hungry. But how do we address it? That's where we have fierce political debate. And you're going to have Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives, people over here and out there and every which way, and we debate how we address the issue. And for some people, some political philosophy, it would be, well, yeah, we need government to provide food stamps and other things so nobody goes on other. It's not the role of government, it's the role of the churches and the nonprofits. Government should butt out of this thing. And I would say, in either case, people are entitled. That's what we should do first, is the private charity. That's what we should do first, the food stamps or the higher wages or whatever the agenda is. But we should keep in mind, in our own mind, as we do that, if I think it should be taken care of through food stamps, well, if I don't win on that and we don't have it taken care of and there's still hungry children, there's still something else. I can't say, well, this is the way I chose to do it and it didn't work, so, well, not my problem. Scripture still says you're supposed to be concerned. If you think, well, I don't think it's the role of government, it's the role of private charity, well, you better be giving a lot of money to those private charities to do it. And if even if you give every penny you've got and it hasn't taken care of the problem, well, the call to be concerned for the poor is still out there. And therefore, well, I guess I didn't have the right answer, or maybe mine was only part of the right answer, and I better find some other way to do it. But in effect, we are supposed to have those political debates based on how we make the world a fair place, where the way we seek justice. Well, how do we get it that George Bush and Al Gore, the same, roughly speaking, the same religious belief, going back to Pat Robertson's day, 1988, there were two Baptist Southern, not Southern Baptist, but two Southerners who were both Baptists running for president, both of them clergy, Baptist clergy. And you probably can't think of the other one off the top of your head, but they were both major candidates, Pat Robertson and Jesse Jackson. Now those two, roughly the same generation, I mean a half a generation apart maybe, but they didn't have much in common about anything. And both of them, I think we can take them at their word, which I think we should do with people, is that they're sincere about this. And Pat Robertson really believed his agenda was the agenda that he should have as a Christian, and Jesse Jackson, I think, similarly so. Yet they agreed on probably close to nothing. That's an exaggeration, but you can take your strongest political opponent and find something you agree with, but they didn't agree on a lot of issues. They wouldn't be running on the same ticket. Well, what shaped the difference? How come they came from different, they, with strong religious faith, came to different backgrounds? Well, they both grew up in the segregated South. Jesse Jackson never knew who his father was. Pat Robertson's father was a military leader and a U.S. senator. One was rich, one was poor, one was black, one was white. You can care to bet that even if they lived in the same small town, which they didn't, in the same age, they wouldn't have had a chance to, their lives wouldn't have crossed that much. They were two totally different circles. And that's to say that how we view the world is shaped in part, we hope in large part, by our faith. But it's also colored by these filters we have on it. Our environment, our educational background, the experiences we have. If you have an identical twin who does everything like you and you come to Holden Village and your twin goes to Disney World, you're going to come up with different views about a number of things. Consumerism, perhaps. But our views are shaped by who we are and how we interpret our faith. So keeping in mind that we're supposed to use our faith and our scriptures to determine who we are, what we believe, and what we value, we should work from there to promote what is our agenda, not God's agenda. We hope, I mean, I think that I should be fighting as hard as I can to do what I think I'm called to do, what I think our faith calls us to do. But as soon as I start describing that to other people as this is God's agenda, no, it's my interpretation of what we're supposed to be doing in the world, just like Pat Robertson has his agenda, what we should be doing in the world and should be promoting what he sincerely believes. The next point I wanted to make in making the connection is recognize something I mentioned earlier, that politicians and political consultants will use faith to try and sell candidates, mainly because a lot of people think, well, I want somebody like me in office. If I'm a Lutheran, I want to have Lutherans in office. And Martin Luther, I think Darrell was pointing in his talk yesterday about how Martin Luther would rather have a competent Muslim running something in government rather than an incompetent or a crooked, than an incompetent, I think is the term, Christian. And I think that some people clearly don't buy it. They want somebody whose religious beliefs are the same as theirs, though we in Lutheran circles who can't agree on what kind of hymns we like to sing. The fact that somebody else is a Lutheran in public office, it does not mean that we're going to agree on things. And as a St. Olaf College graduate, and there are several St. Olaf College graduates in the Minnesota legislature, and they're all over the board politically. And so recognize that political consultants and candidates are trying to use their religious beliefs to get people elected. We use all sorts of things. I have pictures of our family, including the dog in them, in my campaign brochures. Does the dog have anything to do with public policy? No. People who like dogs. One of our first campaigns, we had somebody who volunteered to loan us a dog. We passed on that. But people use religion that way, and I think they want the voters to know they have a faith. Controversial when Joe Lieberman has a faith because his is a different one, and he's an Orthodox Jew, and he obviously takes it seriously, and you know, he's, that can help or hurt. Is the American public ready for a Jewish president, or last time vice president? That was a controversy, or JFK as a Catholic 40 years ago. It was a controversy where people were ready for it, but politicians very carefully try and make sure people know they have a faith, but they don't want anyone to believe they're too much of a true believer or a fanatic. I mean, that hurts. Jimmy Carter, I think people would say he probably crossed the line a little bit because people knew he took his faith really, really, really seriously. Others in more recent years, George Bush, when in one of the debates, who do you most admire? What person do you most admire? And he goes on, Jesus Christ is my personal hero. Well, I was going to say, I think most of us wouldn't want Christ in the group. Okay, well, who are your heroes now? This person, this football player, this movie star, this politician, and Jesus Christ. It struck me as trying to make it very clear how strongly he believed. When Jimmy Carter did some of this and his famous, infamous Playboy interview in which he talked about lusting in his heart. So he was very open, very sincere, very whatever. And I think people recognize that did hurt a little bit. He won the first election despite that, but political consultants are very carefully how you picture somebody, how you put them in place. And politicians want to be open about it, but not too open. And so trusting what they're saying about it is being sincere is hard to do. People often talk about godless people and atheists in government. You look at the biographies of members of U.S. Congress, 434 House members and 100 senators, and I bet you can't find 10 of them who say no religious faith. Everybody else is, I mean, there's a disproportionate amount of probably Episcopalians and Baptists and several other denominations, but certainly to the population, disproportionately Christian and Jewish, Muslim and other minority religions in our country, much less so. But candidates advertise and often advertise heavily their religious faith because they want to, so watch it. I think it was Jim Baker, maybe it was Michael Deaver, I was talking to somebody about this the other day and after communion here. Churches I go to seldom use intinction, and so it's kind of a novelty to see it because I'm not used to common cup or individual cup, but not intinctionless. Well, Ronald Reagan, the Christian Coalition's candidate in the 1980s, Jim Baker, after they left office, Baker wrote about one of the times when he and the First Family were communing together in the Episcopal Church, and Ronald Reagan was following Nancy to the communion line, and Nancy took the host and she dipped it in the chalice and she accidentally dropped it. And Reagan, coming next, dutifully pitches his in too. Baker, Deaver, I think it was Baker's book, talked about the befuddled priest going to the blobs and dump. But it suggests that he wasn't commonly practicing Eucharist, and not that familiar with it. But in other words, be careful, because in image consultants are trying to package people so you know that they're, to create an impression who they are, a good person and so on, which is appropriate for them to do. But the fact that somebody is Christian or whatever faith, judge it from other things, not because they say they are this or pictures of this or however they describe it. A couple other points I'd like to make before opening it up, and I better hustle because we're halfway through the time. One is respect others, no name calling. One of my new colleagues, who I didn't know he was a minister, but he's apparently a minister, one of our environment committee hearings, I chair the environment committee, and he described himself, because we've been dealing with septic and sewage treatment types of issues a lot this year, and he described himself as the septic doctor, which I thought is his job. He's professionally working in sewage treatment issues, and he's very skilled and knowledgeable about that. But he's also apparently, his biography in the state directory lists him as a graduate of some Bible school and a minister. And he got some letter from the religious leadership of Minnesota, Catholic bishops, and it was an interfaith coalition, probably some Lutheran bishops in it too, and so I wrote a letter to legislators, an open letter to state officials saying, you know, as you're dealing with the budget, we're calling on you to be concerned about homelessness and other things, and don't cut the heck out of these things. It's important to us as people of faith. He wrote a letter back, an open letter to the irreligious community of Minnesota, and attacking them for, oh, don't you know that, that Christ wants us to be, it's supposed to, charity comes from the individual, not from government, and that's a way of taking away from the individual, whatever. And he's certainly entitled to his political beliefs and whatever else. I'm just saying, calling somebody, church leaders, among others, is irreligious, is meant to be an insult to them. We have one individual in our state house of representatives who's been in hot water a number of times. One of the times for calling irreligious Jewish liberal to a member of the house who had said something he disagreed with. Irreligious, I didn't know that was an, it's not a typical attack until the last few years they've been calling people irreligious such and such as. I thought it was funny to call somebody an irreligious Jew. but anyhow, the name calling can be fierce. A number of years ago there was a group, I'm trying to think of the name of the group now. I think it was called the Christian Voice, that did morality ratings of members of Congress. And I once worked for Paul Simon, who's a former U.S. Senator from Illinois, and he wrote a column back in the early 80s when this Christian Voice was doing these morality ratings. I don't know if you call it bragging, but pointing out that he got a 0% morality rating. He's son of a Missouri Synod clergyman, and he pointed out that Father Drinan, a Catholic priest before when priests were allowed to be in public office, Father Drinan got a 0, and Bob Edgar, who I think is now head of the National Council of Churches, he got like a 10% rating. And Richard Kelly, a state U.S. Senator from, a U.S. Representative from Florida, got a 100% rating. He was the one convicted in the Epstein bribery scandal. And Simon was pointing out that when somebody calls somebody, morality rating implies that you disagree, you're an immoral person. person, and he was ridiculing how they were doing this. A lot of clergy people were getting zero ratings, and then a crook was getting 100% morality rating. But respecting others, not name-calling. One political consultant a number of years ago was advising candidates, and the paper was following him around as he was doing this, and he was saying, do your best, what you want to do in your literature as effectively as you can is portray your opponent as the scum of the earth. That's the negativity in politics. Name-calling does not help. We can have fierce discussions. The individual who wrote the letter to the irreligious community of Minnesota, I don't agree with him on much, but I respect his right to his views, and he's a decent guy. He's a nice guy. He just, it's a lot harder to be friendly with somebody when they're calling your name. And I guess I appreciate the fact that we can have a fierce debate. And while they may not be my best friends or anything, at least we can be sociable and friendly to each other afterwards. So respecting others. Play fair, bring integrity to the process. Winning elections is important. It's not winning at any cost. Last week I gave a talk on negative campaigning attack ads, that sort of stuff. Because who isn't sickened by what happens now? We want to know why people don't vote. One reason is if you believed half the stuff you heard in the ads, you wouldn't vote for anybody. And it's the political consultants, again, try and use negative ads in a way that makes you think you're not being mean. If people say, oh, this candidate's really smearing that candidate, that'll backfire against them. And consultants and candidates know that. So they try and be as hard-hitting as they can, and they love to kill them with kindness. I had one, oh, yeah. He's well-intentioned, but so naive, or whatever. I was going to say, after I've been in office 15 years, you know, oh, so naive. But they try and, oh, yes, this person is a very well-intentioned, good-hearted, hard-working, but, and then they smear you more than ever, because, and then people say, oh, no, that wasn't a smear, that was, they give you praise, too. Well, you can, the kind of praise you can do without. And one of the things I had proposed in that talk the other day about negative stuff is that if we want to police it through a volunteer campaign code, the best way to do it is allow. I mean, is it appropriate to talk about somebody's personal life if it shows they're being a hypocrite? They're in favor of this, but behind the scenes, politically they want this to be illegal, but behind the scenes they're doing this. Is that inappropriate campaign stuff? I think it's hard. I mean, the reason we can't legally set formal lib prohibitions is because of the First Amendment. And frankly, while I pride myself in not attacking my opponents in campaigns, I'm happy to, in a debate, say they stand for this and I stand for this and have the give and take and hard-hitting stuff. And I don't mind if they want to say really nasty stuff about me. If the candidate themselves says it, you know, they're going to tone it down because they're going to look too bad. You look at all the negative ads you see on TV, not one of them. You see the candidate who's doing it. You see a distorted picture of the opponent. And did you know they did such and such? It's either an anonymous voice or a sweet person talking about this, but never is it identified, and never does it have anything to do with the candidate they're supporting. But playing fair and bringing integrity to the process is a major thing that I think we should recognize. Our faith, anybody's faith, should be calling them to connect politics that way. And it's part of that for us to include in our judgment of the political process whether people play fair or not. And part of this is the difference, recognizing the difference, which everybody in society, not just politicians, have trouble with these days, and that's the difference between law and ethics. There seems to be this new warped ethic that if it's legal, it's okay. You know, it's, oh, I, if it's, it's even past that line now, it's sometimes, if you can get away with it, it's okay, even if it's illegal. But more often, it's the just, well, I can say this about my opponent, it's not illegal. My opponent this last time ran a flyer, we got in the mail the day before the election. 3 o'clock mail pickup on Monday before election day, saying, John Marty says he doesn't take any special interest money, but he took over $19,000 in special interest money, which is a lot given our campaigns are $50,000 or less. And I figured, how could he say that? Because I've had this thing since 1990 that I won't take any PAC money, no lobbyist money, no soft money, no contributions over $100. from anyone. Just small individual contributions, that's what I've done. I ran a statewide race for governor with that limit. My opponent's saying this, well, what happened? Well, the first time I ran in 86, I took, if somebody offered a $1,000 contribution, the limit was $1,500, I would have taken it back then. And I did, and apparently I took 17 or 19,000, whatever he said, that year and the 4 years after that, before I realized how I voluntarily did this on my own. And so he tried to portray it that I was, he could legally do that. Records from campaign finance boards suggest John Marty did this. Clearly the impression was I said this, and I was just raking in the money underhandedly, probably illegally, or at least I was failing to disclose it somehow. And it took me a while to figure out what he meant, but I figured it was back in 15, 16, 17 years ago, I took this money, and he's trying to make it sound like I took it now. And is that fair? I would argue it's not fair. There's no way a normal person could conclude. We got a lot of calls from supporters and opponents on it. I don't think a single one could have figured out how he could get away with that if it was not true. And is that fair? I think what he did was legal, but I don't think it's fair. Then one final thing is in working for, two more things quickly, I'm sorry. One is push for a fair, open, democratic process, including, I would argue, taking money out of the process. Our process no longer speaks to the merits of the issues, it speaks to who gives the most money, and I think we should be, as a matter of faith, we should be trying to make the process work for people and for public interest rather than who can buy government, buy access to government. And then finally, I would argue that in politics, we are supposed to use our faith in a way that provides leadership to serve others, and leadership is not the way it's been portrayed in recent years. Leadership is not doing what's popular, it's doing what you believe to be right and trying to move people there. I think the best, every candidate, if you look at their literature, is going to say great leadership skills, providing strong leadership. I put that in my brochures, I believe it, and I try my best to do it. But leadership does not mean seeing a parade moving this way and you get a flag and step in front of the parade and I'm leading. No, you're not leading. You just jumped in front and claiming credit for what's happened. Leadership means Martin Luther King seeing this and saying, wait a minute, and we're trying to move people. We're going to move people in a different direction, building coalitions, building whatever it takes, moving public policy in a different direction, perhaps. That might require leadership. Leadership is not always popular. Sometimes leaders are popular. Many times they're very unpopular because of their leadership. And finally, you compromise on public policies. Perfectly okay. Compromise is not a dirty word. If you want to get this thing to clean up the environment and you can only get half of that compromise, if that's the good compromise is different from bad compromise, but if you can only get a tenth of what you want, but you were lucky to get anything at all, it might be a good compromise, but you never compromise on your values. You keep fighting for what you believe. Well, we got this little bit, we got a half a loaf this time, but we're fighting for more because you don't change what you believe. Compromise of your values is wrong, but compromise of ideas is not. I talked way too long, we only have about 20 minutes left, but I'd like to open it up for discussion, questions, challenges, whatever.
You mentioned the word leadership, and I had an occasion last year to meet a woman who, very nice woman, but I also knew she had a very strong, conservative, Christian kind of retreat center that she was running, and it's a long, complicated story, but my husband, Paul, and I, who's in politics, ran into her, and we were chatting with her, and she found out he was in politics, and oh, she wanted us to come up and be a part of this leadership group, and she kept using the word leadership, and in my background, when I hear from political stuff, leadership, I'm thinking more managerial, kind of very clean cut, really non-religious, more, you know, leadership. And I've also heard there's this, in Minneapolis, there's this guy on the TV who has this big Christian, Mac Hammond, and he talks a lot of times about leadership. And am I just being naive, or is this kind of a code word for, the way I interpret after I'm hearing these people is, this is like, I'm thinking, what is the purpose? They're not trying to make, you know, people be on the school board or any of these kinds of things. is this a way of trying to convert people or go out and bring people into the fold and say, you know, this is how you're going to, you know what I'm saying?
I think I do. I'm not, probably I'll try to take a crack at it. Well, people, whether they use the term leadership or whatever, we use buzzwords for what we want. I mean, somebody who's talking heavily leadership in a, who's running some sort of Christian community, maybe trying to get people who are leaders in whatever the agenda of the organization or whatever is. And maybe if that is a very conservative interpretation of scripture or whatever, we want leaders who will push that agenda. Leadership is not fundamentally, it's an important skill to have, but it's not good per se. I mean, an evil leader can be very effectively moving a country or a society to do horrendous things. I was looking over my notes this morning up in the library, there's a book on Adolf Hitler, Child's Book of the Rise and Fall of Adolf Hitler. I mean, talk about very effective leadership and for a very sick, twisted, evil purpose. So I don't know if it's used as a buzzword for something. I wouldn't have thought of leadership as being tied to a certain faith groups. And I'm not familiar with the TV person you're talking about, but yes, leadership is considered a good skill. I mean, political and business and everybody else promotes leadership. I think leadership is an important thing to do, and I'm saying provide leadership for what you think is right, what you think are the right values. I think it's very important to do. And my use of the word leadership was to say, contrast leadership from trying to do what's popular and describe that as leadership. In their case, what their agenda is, I don't know, but the use of the word leadership, I wouldn't see that as a buzzword for something.
Well, it just made me very suspect, and I felt like if we kind of naively said, sure, we'll come, and everybody's nice, and, you know, da-da-da, that we kind of almost cultish be sucked into some, I don't know.
Well, people, people all kinds of, yeah, remember of our congregation about 20 years ago when we first married, wanted to come over and meet with us. Weren't sure what you wanted to meet with us about. Oh, I'll explain that. Can we just have a set of time to come meet with you? Or you can come to our house. And we figured, well, we had him over and it was, Amway or Shaki. Should have known. That was the first time I ever went close with it. And kept going, do you ever want more control, more money? No, we're fine. Do you ever want more free time to think more? Well, actually, we're pretty content right now. And I mean, we gave him all the answers that, wait a minute, it didn't fit his script. But, I mean, he clearly had an agenda. It wasn't a terrible agenda. It was one I had zero interest in. But we see something as what we believe and we want to persuade others to join us in, whether it's working for justice because of our faith, or whether it's trying to clean up the environment because we want that. We try and persuade others to come along, and however you do it, but I don't see leadership as a buzzword per se. At least I haven't seen any being used heavily by one group and not other. Over here, and then over here.
There are two points. The first one, the Constitution is against the established church, and the ACLU and others. This is my view.
Sure.
They're distorting politics and state, and that was a serious problem for taking advantage of our knowledge. The second point is, as a leader, our job is not to seek justice, but is to seek mercy. If we seek to propose our view of justice, we are very, well, we're citizens, but we're not Lutherans. Lutherans should seek mercy, because with justice, we're all God. We need mercy. We can say we believe in Jesus and say, well, we were our view of justice. We need mercy.
Let me quickly respond to the first one, then the second one a little more. On the first one, the American Civil Liberties Union, I'm not a member of it, but I know lots of people who are, many of whom are strong Christians. And frankly, and we have a state legislature, and I always thought this was bizarre, but it's a practice that's gone on forever, and it will continue, I'm sure. And that is, we pay somebody to come pray for us. I always thought a prayer is something we can do ourselves, but the state pays, and this is true of federal government too, pays a chaplain to come and pray in front of the legislature every year. And we have big debates over what's appropriate kind of prayers there. Because some people, we have Jewish members of our Senate, and I presume some people who don't have any faith, but I don't know, very few people advertise, I'm an atheist. Despite some people's saying atheists are taking over the country and our government and everything else, I think you could hold a convention of the National Association of Atheists in a telephone booth sometimes. it's not a large, most vast majority of Americans have belief in a supreme being, whether it's through a Christian perspective or Jewish or Islamic tradition, whatever. Most Americans, most people believe in a supreme being. Most have a belief in God. I think when a state judge in Alabama who gets elected in elected office in Alabama, like in most states, to Supreme Court, saying he is going to put the Ten Commandment tablets in the courtroom, and because that's what all Americans believe because of that, I mean, I'm troubled by that. I don't think that's a healthy thing. And the U.S. Supreme Court says he's not allowed to do that. He's simply not allowed to do that. When I grew up, there's some changes, and some of them are uncomfortable for us. When I grew up, I remember loving December during the school year because every day we'd have 2 hours to go off prepare for the Christmas pageant. And I learned the 6 verses of It Came Upon a Midnight Clear, 4, however many there are. I could still probably get most of them by memory. We also had the same thing at church, of course, but we did the same thing there. And I don't know if I had a lot of Jewish classmates in school. Probably not. But I frankly think that the religious teachings should come in church and home, not in the school. School shouldn't be afraid to talk about religion, I think. Studying faith, I mean, it's very important. You can't pretend like the pilgrims came to the United States because they thought it was a neat place to go. They came over for religious reasons, and we ought to study that. But there's a difference between studying and promoting and so on. In the second part of your question, I wanted to talk about the mercy and justice. When I'm talking about justice here, and when Micah, the prophet, is saying we should seek justice, it doesn't mean, okay, somebody committed this crime, we're going to get justice for them. In that case, yeah, you're right. What we as Lutherans want is we want mercy. We're sinners. We do terrible things. We want mercy. This justice isn't the justice of so-and-so did this, we're going to punish you that way. This is the justice of creating a just society, a society in which people treat each other with love and respect, and people don't go, we don't have people who are, pray for the widow and the orphan, we read. You read Amos talking about how God does not want, he hates our sacrificial rituals and so on. What he wants us to do, he calls, in one verse in Amos, he calls us cows, or the people that are cows, because they're raping the poor, kind of thing. He's talking about working for justice. The Old Testament prophets are very clear on that. And the way I see it is, Ron Sider, the theologian, wrote a book a number of years ago, Rich Christians in the Age of Hunger. And a powerful book. I read it first when I was in college, and I thought, I disagree with the guy strongly. He's not Lutheran, and not a Lutheran perspective. His was, if you don't do this and this and this and give all your money to the poor, you're going to be damned to hell, and you better be scared about that. Ours is more, Christ has given us salvation. We are thankful. We are grateful for it. How do we show our gratitude? By taking care of the poor, by doing what Scripture asks us to do. So I don't disagree with you at all about the concept of mercy versus justice, meaning justice is punishment for things. I think what I'm referring to here in the seeking of justice is the making sure that same thing Jubilee talks about, you know, that people who are enslaved, people who are in debt, people who are in other things are freed from that, and they're given a new chance at life. The poor are given sufficient needs to be met. That's what I meant by the seeking of justice, because I don't disagree with you on the way you were interpreting justice. I fully agree. We need mercy. Over there.
I had a question. I'm just curious about what you think is the best way to get accurate level information about candidates that are running. You know, I'm a mother, I have three small children, I have a very busy life. I try to keep up, you know, I listen to NPR when I can, and, you know, and I find the media is such a machine, and you get, you know, just like that guy in Minneapolis who's a good Christian, you know, gave a lot of money to Augsburg, they were going to name the thing after him, but he had this hidden agenda. There's a lot of organizations, and I find this too when I get things in the mail for charitable organizations. I think this sounds great, but I have no
way of judging,
way of knowing what is going on underneath this organization. Maybe if I give my money to there, I may be giving it to a really evil purpose that I would judge as a bad thing, but I have no way of knowing that because it's face value and there it is.
And after September 11th, we saw a lot in the Somali community and so on, where people were giving money to go back home and finding out maybe some of it was being channeled to Al-Qaeda, probably a small number of people who were really trying to help, some were sending it to the wrong place. Mm-hmm. How do you judge it? Well, the same way it's hard to judge with a charity, it's hard to judge in politics. I like to suggest, I mean, this Christian Voice doing morality ratings. Well, if you know what the Christian Voice's agenda was at the time, you can figure out who they're going to be name-calling, who they're going to be praising. In agriculture, I did not grow up on a farm. I'm not very closely tied to farming, but I know there's a big difference between the Farmers Union and Farm Bureau. If I want to say I'm good on agriculture, the Farmers Union gives me 100% score. If my opponent wants to criticize me, if we had farms in our district, I don't. We had a farm museum once. But in the St. Paul Agriculture Campus for a few years, which is a farm campus. If my opponent would attack me, he'd say, boy, John Murray gets tens or zeros from the Farm Bureau. Well, if you know what the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union stand for, that can mean something to you. And the same thing if you know what Sierra Club means, or we have some environmental groups that I would argue are not, is one who considers himself an environmentalist, ones that are sort of run by business interests I would argue not really an environmental agenda, they're more a business agenda that many environmentalists would say is anti-environment. The same way in terms of trying to judge candidates, voting records can be helpful as long as you know where the group's coming from. And there is, the simple answer to your question is there's no easy way to find out a lot about politics. The more different sources you can use, reliable sources, yes, not talk radio, but even I like news stories that get into a little more depth. But whether certain radio and newspapers and magazines and internet sources, and take everything with a grain of salt. But it does help when there are groups that you know you trust. See what they say about candidates, because a lot of them do. There's a League of Conservation Voters, and I was really mad at them a few years ago because they had us fill out this lengthy questionnaire, and I'm sure I had 100% on their voting record several years. So I knew they would endorse me. I mean, what was I going to get out of the endorsement? I could put on my campaign literature endorsed by a League of Conservation Voters. And then they said, no, we're sorry. We're focusing on a handful of candidates this year. And even though I wasn't asking for money or anything, all I wanted was to be able to say I had their stamp of approval, in effect. And I was mad at them because I went through all this work and they ignored it. But usually groups like that, even those that don't endorse candidates, will sometimes do voting records. Sometimes they're not voting records of the sort where we give people a percentage rating. Sometimes the Minnesota Senior Federation will have questions and how do you feel about this kind of legislation, this, and they just put the answers down there. Sometimes they're just yes, no ones. I've always fought with our League Women Voters, which when I was running for governor, they, do you support workers' comp reform? Yes, no. no other choice. I said, well, I wrote a note to them saying I thought the questionnaire was terrible, because I said, I strongly support workers' comp reform, and I know my opponent will say he strongly supports workers' comp reform, and what he means by reform and I mean by reform are exact opposite. And exact opposite. And I said that this question is absolutely meaningless. And the League of Women Voters, I thought, should have done better than that. But you take groups that you trust and you try and figure out from how they do it. There are lots of ways, but going on too long.
One of the challenges, though, is that that's assuming that the person has a voting record.
Oh, that's true.
In an elected
that's
office.
True.
Or they're running for, like you, if you run for re-election for the same position, you know, when you ran for governor, or if you were going to run for in a different position, the issues might not have anything
to do with...
It'd be
different running at a different level, right.
Right.
And there is no perfect way to do that. You have to judge the literature. That's why I, even though I don't like negative campaigning and so on, I think it's not bad. I think debates are one of the healthiest things in the process. Abe Lincoln and Stephen Douglas in their debates, things where people come from, I mean, it was all-day affair. People on horseback ride 30 miles to get 5,000 people to listen to these guys argue without microphones, outdoors. Mm-hmm. A massive crowd, how they could talk, I don't know. But they argued, and they called each other nasty names. I mean, really, things that I wouldn't consider appropriate in terms of it's not courteous. It's not nice to call people that. But again, if I'm willing to say, call you something, you're my opponent, and we're calling each other names ourselves and doing it, the public can decide. Are we using overkill? I can say, you're really mean-spirited in doing this. Or you can say, you really did a disgusting thing in doing that. If we go overboard and start calling each other all kinds of vicious things, it's going to backfire against us. But I think it's important to have a harsh, strong debate. I like to have a more positive tone than people do, but I think that that in a new candidate, it's very hard to judge. My opponent, I had 20 pages of issue papers when I first ran. I think people joke the only person who read them all was my opponent, so he could attack me. But he had stuff about he was an Eagle Scout, he was captain of the college football team, all these other things he did, a brochure that was just glamorous photos of his wife and how what a wonderful husband he was. Not a single position on any issue other than attacking where I stood on things. And how are people to judge it? Both papers endorsed him, and he was the one who was supposed to win, and I kind of sensed I didn't have a chance. So in the end, after one of them wouldn't even interview me, sent him all my position papers and said, I'm going to do you the favor of sending you all the literature of every kind I've gotten from my opponent since the beginning, so you can see, because he said nothing about a single issue. And he was supposed to win. It wasn't because of the issue papers, it was because I worked harder than him, I think. Anyway, we have time for about two more, quickly. Yes, here and then here.
Go ahead.
In response to what you're saying, as much as possible, I think that it's very important that we ask one another the questions. So if you have a candidate mm-hmm. who you are concerned about or who is running and you want to get to know, I say go directly to the candidate as much
right.
as you possibly
right.
can.
At a local level, you can do this.
And they have representatives,
mm-hmm.
you know, at a local level, if you can't get directly to
right.
that candidate, then they have representatives in your district who represent them.
Mm-hmm.
But my perspective, and I always believe this is true, is as much as you can, ask direct
right.
questions to
that's,
the...
That's very important. Our local... My local city mayor was elected last time saying he was the candidate willing to talk about the issues, the only one with the courage to talk about the issues. And I like that. I really respect that. His brochures didn't have anything on it. It said go to his webpage. So you go to his webpage and issue section, under development. The last time I looked was 2 weeks before the election, and I forgot to check after that, but still never had any issue. He was talking about how he's talking about the issues without saying anything. But what you do then is you get on the phone and you call them. Say you keep saying you're talking about issues. What are you talking about? Where are you talking about? How can I see it? And at a local mayoral race in a city the size of mine, or Minneapolis City Council, or State Senate, or I mean California state senators represent well over 500,000 people, larger than congressional districts. New Hampshire state representative represents 3,000 people. That's small town, and everybody knows everybody. And you can't, frankly, expect the President of the United States, you can't ask the President what you do, but most local offices, you can ask people. That's a really good point.
It will also tell you something about the candidate, whether, I live in California.
Yeah.
Whether they are responsive on any level or not.
If they don't care, you're just one of those, we don't need your vote anyhow.
That's right.
But you're, it's a good point, a good way to answer the question. Yeah.
What's happened to the faith-based initiative?
Oh, the Bush's faith-based initiative? One of the people in charge of it kind of resigned after a while, but it's the difficulty with dealing with it is it's kind of a little bit unclear. I mean, Lutheran Social Services in Minnesota gets a lot of government money because not for sectarian purpose things, which they should not, and they're not allowed to use them for that. But if they're doing chemical dependency treatment, if they are doing a lot of things for services for people with disabilities and so on, that sort of thing, nonprofit organizations, including religious-based ones, have been getting money for in the past. I think the Bush initiative was largely to say, hey, we don't even mind if at some points they will use some of this money and stuff where they are evangelizing. Like a homeless shelter, I mean, 20 years ago, the homeless shelters in Minnesota were for mentally ill and chemically dependent people. And there's Union Gospel Mission, and they don't ask, nor do I think they receive public funding for their shelter. But they would be evangelizing the people that came in, telling them drinking alcohol is evil and believe this. And I think the Bush administration would tend their faith-based initiative, which has been controversial among the religious community, is that they would move the line over of what's acceptable behavior while you are receiving government money for it. I think that it's appropriate to talk about it. I think the specifics of it get real touchy and how you do it, because I mean there's some people who are big believers that something like chemical dependency, a faith-based approach, maybe, I mean, we as the public may want the best way to get people free from their chemical dependency, and I would have real problem deceiving people you're going into this program, and basically what they're trying to do is convert you to this or persuade you to that. But I think we should recognize it's not like, oh, it's always been prohibited, now it's going to be all allowed. It's LSS in Minnesota does get a lot of government grants for the services it provides. Lots of denominational run nursing homes that are almost entirely publicly funded. And we have hospital chaplains at public hospitals and at prisons. So it's a question of like who's funding the chaplains, who's funding the religious part as opposed to the social service that's provided. And that's but how where the faith-based initiative is, I think there was more talk, and by the time it gets down to the specifics, there's not as much difference because people aren't comfortable moving too far from where it's been, I think. I think we have to call it quits now. I'm happy to stay around for a few more minutes. I'm leaving after lunch, but happy to talk a little bit more if you had questions or comments or concerns about this. But I hope this does help inform the way you might be thinking about how does my faith relate to it, because I don't want to be doing something inappropriate, and I find it offensive when a candidate does such and such, but nevertheless, I mean, what I believe is what I want to be pushing in the political system. I think that's what we all have to wrestle with, what's appropriate way, and I hope this helps. Thank you for your attention.